Hello and welcome to your Midsummer Culture File Weekly, where this time Norwegian composer Christine Sjørgensen offers a refreshing dip in her fish-forward pelagic dreamscape. We meet the first man to be arrested wrongly with the help of AI facial recognition technology and join a whiff-waff powwow at a table tennis installation at the Crawford in Cork. But we begin at this week's Pipeworks Organ and Choral Festival in Dublin, which offers not just plenty of music from visitors and local organists, but also a chance to see inside some of Dublin's landmark small churches. Organist and music scholar Geoffrey Webber played this week in Sanford Church in Ranelagh, where the Great Rose Window keeps an eye on activities on Marlborough Road, and where Culture File's Niamh Daly went to meet him as he was getting to know the church's 19th century instrument.
Okay, yeah, that sounds good. I'm good.
Okay. It was never a puzzle for me to know what to do. I just felt that that was me. That's where I got most excited and I want to perform. And it's like a vocation. I've just never really thought I would want to do anything else in my life. My name is Geoffrey Webber. I'm an organist, a conductor, and musicologist. So I've just arrived in Dublin this afternoon and came straight to Sanford. And I've been practicing the organ this afternoon and getting to know it for the first time, which has been a delight. It's an organ that dates from the late 19th century, but it's been adapted a few times and very carefully and lovingly restored in the last few years. Curated by David O'Shea, who's the organist here. I grew up in Bournemouth in Dorset, and I was fortunate to be given the opportunity to become a chorister at the nearest cathedral, which was Salisbury in Wiltshire. So I was a boy chorister from about the age of 8 to 13, singing during the term time, almost daily services. So it was quite a busy schedule alongside the ordinary schoolwork. And in the holiday times at home in Bournemouth, I used to go to the Winter Gardens there and to listen to the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra. My parents both sang in the Bournemouth Symphony Chorus, so that was another reason why I got involved in music. Well, I took up playing the organ when I was at secondary school at the King's School in Worcester. So I studied the piano mainly when I was smaller and then took up the organ in earnest only age sort of 15 or 16. But because my hand technique was quite advanced by that stage, it was quite quick to learn how to add the feet to it and so tackle the organ. When I left school, I was fortunate enough to get a scholarship to go to Oxford, and there I could study music more generally, but also play the organ with an organ scholarship at New College, which was where I studied. I'm writing a history of Anglican church music, so in the Church of England and the Church of Ireland, which has been a little bit forgotten now, but there's some lovely music associated with the types of services that were common at that time. I'm taking advantage of being here by going to study some of the old manuscripts in the archive here in Dublin, the music manuscripts that were used to perform the church music in Christchurch Cathedral and St Patrick's Cathedral. And there's some music that survives here in Dublin that doesn't survive anywhere in the UK. So it's very good to have the opportunity to spend a bit of time in the library as well as performing, as I've always enjoyed a mixture of scholarships, research, as well as performance. One of my former trips to Ireland, I was fortunate to take part in the early music festival in Galway. And at that time I was making a recording of music called In Praise of St Columba, with a wonderful player of the ancient instrument, the triple pipes or laudellus, called Barnaby Brown. And together we were exploring the style of music that would have been familiar to St. Columba. So it's obviously quite conjectural, but there's been a lot of work done recently on reviving the triple pipe as an instrument. And it's a little bit like a bagpipes. It's not quite the same, but it's you play it with circular breathing. It's got two drones and a separate line where you play the tune. And we experimented with different ways of singing the ancient chant along with the pipes that would elaborate with it to create completely new and wonderful sounds. We had horns that were modelled on horns that had been found in a bog somewhere in the northern part of Ireland. So we used bells, horns, pipes. The idea of plain song we have today is rather austere voices only in large echoey spaces. But in Columba's day, in the first millennium, this music would have played in much smaller churches, much drier acoustics, and instruments were very often used with the voices. So completely different style of singing. So it was a very fascinating project.
Geoffrey Webber there in that report from Niamh Daly, and he was in Dublin as part of the Pipeworks Organ and Choral Festival, which continues around the capital until Sunday, more about which from pipeworks.ie. The National Novelty Ping Pong Table Collection is a project dreamed up by the curatorial duo Davy Moore and Pete Prendergast back in 2016. The project commissions artists to design and build entertaining but playable, tricky, crazy table tennis tables. Then artists and art world workers compete at an annual table tennis tournament, smashing their balls across the likes of Ella Bertelsson's Monster Munch table, commissioned in 2022, or Moore and Prendergast's own Swiss Waff, a Swiss cheese-themed table they made in 2016. For the Midsummer Festival, visitors also get their chance to serve up some aces across the most recent crazy table titled Got the Snip, created by Cork artist Eleanor O'Donovan. And last Saturday, all the tables hosted a Crinu-Nanode tournament, to which Culturefile's Rachel Andrews brought her microphone.
I am lucky enough to live with a very lovely but sometimes temperamental black cat. And so Misha, the black cat, was the inspiration for the black cat on the ping pong table.
My name is Eleanor O'Donovan. I am a visual artist from Cork.
My table in particular is called Got the Snip. It's a handmade ping pong table featuring a big black cat painted on it. And it's maybe a bit of a rude joke. The ping pong balls are little black balls to resemble a part of the cat that might be missing. It's kind of bright and colourful and a big cartoon graphic image. I was really interested in using kind of pop colours, primary colours, blue, red, yellow and black to make a really graphic, cartoony image. Because ping pong is really fun and active, and I wanted an image that kind of reflected that.
I had come across the project a few years ago because I was on a residency in Portugal and made a ping pong table. And my friends in Dublin were like, hey, have you heard of this thing that's happening? So it was just so serendipitous that a few years later I was invited to make this ping pong table because they had no idea that I made a ping pong table in Portugal.
Do you like ping pong or like, do you ever play?
The way that I describe my practice is that it's kind of playful and like fun and like humorous. So the idea to make a ping pong table kind of felt like a good fit a few years ago. So I like ping pong. I'm not particularly like good at it or particularly into it, but it felt like a sort of a fun, funny thing to make at the time.
My name is Davy Moore. I'm a curator and registrar, and I run the King Ping Pong event every year. I used to work in a gallery called Monster Truck, and myself and the director, Pete Prendergast, used to play table tennis a lot. I said, well, why don't we do a table tennis tournament for our friends in the visual arts? It was really, really good fun. And then a year later, we thought, well, we might as well do it again. The artists made tables didn't come till later. We made a crazy table. I kind of had the idea that it would be nice to save them all up.
So
This is Swiss Waff, which is a table actually that myself and Peter Prendergast made. We made the original one of these in 2016 and it got destroyed, unfortunately. So we remade this for the last show we did, which was in 2022, and changed it a little bit. So it had holes in it, the original one. So we kept the holes and kept the kind of weird kind of wedge shape and turned it into two blocks of Swiss cheese, and we called it Swiss Waff. The net is a kind of a what you might wrap cheese in. It's kind of cling wrap.
Was there any particular reason you were inspired to make a sort of a cheesy?
No, not really. The original one just had some certain cheesy elements to it, I suppose, with the holes and the kind of weird wedge shapes that were cut out of it just by chance. And so, yeah, when we remade this one, we made it cheese yellow, and I kind of put this rind around. Is it rind? Is that what they call it? The red stuff around it, I think it's called rind. So we have that. So it's, yeah, up the cheese factor a little bit.
It was interesting because, you know, Davey obviously came with some criteria that, like, the table had to be playable, it had to be sort of transportable, and it had to, you know, subscribe, like, fit a certain height and a certain kind of dimension. So that was kind of giving me a box to think outside of. But when I was thinking about the table, first of all, I was looking at all the tables that had been made before. And I guess a lot of the artists who've made tables are sculptors, or they're quite sort of tactile in their practices. So the way that they interpreted a ping pong table was to kind of change the landscape of the table, like to add things on the side or to add holes or obstacles. But for me, I would consider myself more of an image maker, and like I wanted to make a kind of visual joke. So it was a case of kind of creating a sense of irony between the image on the table and people actually playing with the balls in this case. I came up with probably about 30 ideas. 32, Davey is telling me. Like 32 ideas, varying in levels of intelligence and nuance. In terms of intelligence and nuance, this table is kind of low on the list, but it was one of the ones that I kind of felt like, oh, this is an Eleanor O'Donovan table, you know?
In terms of the shows, like, so Wiff Off is playing at my gaff, which we've done in the complex, and now here, no, that's open to everybody. It's the King Ping Pong tournament, which we ran last night, which was won by Fergal Gaynor of Enclave Review in a nail-biting final with Dobbs O'Brien from the National Sculpture Factory. They're both absolutely amazing players. Art people socialise a lot, and they go out a lot, and it's at openings, and so they're talking, generally when they're there, they're talking about art. And so this was a way of bringing all the same people together, but actually having them talk about something different. That was really the motivation behind it.
Wiff Waff is playing at My Gaff is open to the public at the Crawford Art Gallery, Cork, until July 7th, and it's free. You possibly think your face is unique, and unless you're an identical twin, it likely is. Yet facial recognition software often misidentifies people, especially those of colour, sparking civil liberties concerns. In the US, the technology is widely used despite accuracy issues, though some cities are starting to ban it. Meanwhile, Ireland is considering a bill to authorise its use by the Gardaí. The Irish Council for Civil Liberties recently held a Dublin screening of Coded Bias, a documentary on the technology's failings. In Dublin for the occasion was perhaps the earliest victim of AI-aided policing, Robert Williams, wrongfully arrested in Detroit in a case that was at turns Kafkaesque and Orwellian. Culture Files' Louise Williams reports.
I have many names. I am called Mathematical Model, Evaluation, Assessment, Tool. But by many names, I am an algorithm. I am a black box.
My name is Robert Williams. I'm 46 years old. I'm originally from Detroit, Michigan. I currently live in Farmington Hills, Michigan. I am a logistics planner for an automotive company, and I am married and have two daughters, Julia and Olivia.
Bring me into 2020. Do you mind describing what happened?
Got a phone call at work from my wife saying the police just called her and told her that I need to turn myself in. I was like, what are you talking about? I said, somebody must be trying to prank call you. And she said, well, they're going to call you. I just gave them your phone number. I said, okay. While I was somewhere okay, my line was beeping in and I was getting another call. I said, that's probably them. She said, answer it. I said, okay. I answered the phone and the police said, come turn yourself in. Are you Robert Williams? And I said, yes, I am. And I said, what am I turning myself in for? They said, I can't tell you that, but this is a serious matter. I said, I'm not going to do that. I said, I'm going home. And he was like, oh, well, we'll meet you at your house. I was on my way home. I called my wife to ask if I needed to bring home dinner. And she said, the police are here. I said, what? She said, they're in the doorway. I told her to get the police out of my house. And I'll be home in a minute. And I pull in the driveway. They pull in behind me and block me in. And they approached me. And one said, are you Robert Williams? And I said, yes, I am. And he said, you're under arrest. And I said, no, I'm not. And then he said, you don't tell us, we're the police. So then my wife is like, she's giving me this look while holding my two-year-old at the time. She's like, don't resist. And I'm like, I'm not resisting. So I put the cuffs on and I'm like, I want to see the warrant. And it said felony larceny at the top. And I said to myself, felony larceny would be stealing, right? And he was like, I'm just here to serve the warrant.
The police drove Robert to a detention center where he was frisked a number of times and told to remove his shoelaces. At first, Robert felt confident that his case was going to be quickly cleared up. He'd be able to go home soon to his family. But the hours passed and there was no sign of him being released. Eventually, he was taken to talk to some detectives who showed him some blurry images of a black man who had committed theft. Robert was able to provide evidence in the form of his face that he wasn't this suspect. He was eventually let go, although he still had to show up in court 10 days later for the case to be dropped. He'd been held in custody for almost 30 hours in total.
Robert's case was the first publicly known case in the United States of a wrongful arrest after police relied on an incorrect match from face recognition technology. I'm Nate Fried Wessler. I'm an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. I specialize in issues around digital privacy and police practices, so police surveillance technologies and police searches of our sensitive information. It's glitchy in general, and multiple studies have shown that it works particularly poorly on darker skinned people. It has just higher misidentification rates for people of color, particularly black people.
The ACLU ran its own test of Amazon's facial recognition software. They found that it falsely matched the faces of 28 members of Congress with faces that had been placed in a mugshot database. Congress members who were people of color were misidentified at even higher rates.
This technology, because of the training data that it's been trained on, because of color contrast settings on digital cameras that end up washing out the faces of darker skinned people. And for other reasons, it just doesn't work as well on people of color. And as a result, there's this terrible amplification of already disparate policing practices. So, you know, in the United States, we have been working for several years to encourage elected officials to actually just ban police from using this technology. We think this is a technology that is just fundamentally dangerous in the hands of law enforcement. And it's dangerous not only when it fails, because of these wrongful arrests that we've seen. But it's also dangerous when it works. I use scare quotes around that. Even if this technology is actually correctly identifying people some of the time, it's giving police just an incredible power to surveil us, to identify us in a way that was never possible before. And it so lowers the cost of mass surveillance that we think it is just incompatible with a free and open democratic society.
Robert Williams is suing the Detroit police for his wrongful arrest. That case is still ongoing. But he's having a harder time explaining what happened to his daughters, who are still acting out the impact of seeing their father being arrested. It's not as simple as telling his older daughter that the computer got it wrong.
She was mad at me because I told her I'd be right back. And I wasn't right back. I was gone for over a day, And she had to go to school the next morning, and she lost a tooth, and daddy's still not home, right? So I'm talking to her, and I'm like, I didn't do anything. I said, the police, because it's just weird to explain it to a child because you want to tell them all the time that the police are their friend, and then to tell them that the police can make mistakes also.
Robert Williams there in that report from Louise Williams, and the documentary Coded Bias is streaming on Netflix. For the first time ever this year, a European capital of culture is located within the Arctic Circle. And as regular listeners will know, that city is Bodø in northern Norway. Among the year's cultural projects, some of which we've heard about on previous episodes, many explore the unique ways culture in this part of the world is powered by the sea, the life in it and around it. One of the most complete examples of this was the premiere of Pelagic Dreamscape, a new orchestral work by the Norwegian composer Christine Jorgensen, which coaches orchestral musicians into a range of unaccustomed practices in search of the music of orcas and kittiwakes and guillemots and haddock and powerboats. After her Bodø premiere, Christine Jorgensen spoke to Culturefile about transcribing the sound of an Arctic seascape.
My name is Christine Jorgensen, and I'm a composer. Live in Oslo. Now we are in Bodø, in the Stormen, is the culture house here, concert house here in Bodø. And we just heard the Norwegian premiere of my piece, Pelagic Dreamscape, with the Arctic Philharmonic.
So tell us a little bit about the piece. There's a kind of scientific underpinning to begin with.
Yeah, because actually I was staying at Røst, this island in the middle of the ocean here. Like, it's 2 hours with the ferry from Bodø. And I met some bird enthusiasts there. And we went around and I was listening to the birds. And I also met, like, a scientist from the... from Bergen, the institute there, and got some recording of fishes and orcas and so the marine biologists I've been meeting. So for me, it's very important to make this life form speak and sing in my music, because we don't know so much about it, or I think like the people don't know so much about fishes. I think they are it's very quiet underwater, but it's so much sound. They talk together, actually. Sound is very important in the life of the fishes. So yeah, for me that was mind-blowing when I got to know this. For the underwater recordings, I got the recordings from scientists, but the birds, I've done a lot of the recording myself, but I don't use the recordings in my pieces. I transcribe it very, I use a lot of time on finding the right instrument, the right instrumentation, and also like when I listen to these recordings and listen to it like the first time I heard a bird, but if you listen to these recordings 50 times, then you suddenly hear the whole landscape opening up. So for me, I try to transcribe the landscape that you things you don't hear when you walk, when you are sitting in a place, you don't hear everything because you just hear some things. And for me, it's very interesting that the whole landscape opens up and it's so musical.
I mean,
I mean, it's a lot more musical when it's become your piece, though.
Yeah, I have to like choose how to present it or to give it to the audience. I think it's a gift in a way too.
One of the things about the piece is it's quite demanding for the musicians in that there's almost no, there's none of the music they played in school is played there. Everything is a kind of an extended technique of one sort or another, most of it anyway.
Not everything, I think, but for me, I'm also a musician, a clarinet player, and I played a lot of contemporary music. And for me, it's important that the musician, they would like to play this kind of music because it's so much, they have so much against contemporary music, and especially in orchestra, I know, because I played a lot in orchestra myself. But for me, it's important that they feel that what they are doing and playing in the piece is important, and it's a reason why they are sitting there and play this music. And they are actually very positive. And for me also, that because when you add these very new techniques, in especially in like orchestra music, then the plays are very classical trained, most of them. So then we have to be very pedagogic in a way to, and I make films with the technique so they can watch and learn, so they don't feel stupid, because I think that's the main key or to that they feel comfortable in doing these things and know how to do it. But I also made this special bow for the cello with it's a tube bow with riller, it's called in Norwegian. It's
holes in it,
not holes, but it's
Ridges
in it, so it makes the same sound as the orcas, and it's have to be exactly like 16 millimeter tube and this kind of stick, so it's very, I go very scientific into all these details, so I know it works. So they actually bought wrong tube and I had to find a new one. And also the contrabass are using this milk steamer that I prepared to make the sound of like boat motors, like yeah. For me, it sounds like it's supernatural or dreamy, all these sounds. So like the real world is the most exciting things, like the everyday sounds. For me, it can, when you listen to it, it becomes totally magical. So I think people take the everyday sound for granted, and the sound world around you can be make your life so rich.
Composer Christine Sjogerson and her work Pelagic Dreamscape, which premiered as part of Buda, European Capital of Culture. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more sound diving next Saturday tea time. Till then, bye now.